You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and back with us is my co-host extraordinaire, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
Hey,
so,
Alan.
So, Melody, tell me a little bit. How was your weekend?
Oh, my weekend was great.
Great. And the holidays. In fact, if I recall, you were going to do some work with your horses. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm really excited about this. If I could take a moment here.
Oh, please do.
Because for any of our professional listeners who are in Southern California, what I'm doing now is I'm providing adjunct services for equine-assisted psychotherapy, which we've talked a lot about here on our show, and to them in the work that they're doing with their current clients. And what I'm really excited about is coming up on January 25th, in the Murrieta Riverside area, I'm doing a demonstration for all the professional mental health professionals as well as treatment centers in order to give them a demonstration on how exactly this works, because really the best way to know how it works is to experience it yourself. So it's experiential demonstration. And then the following week, I just got teamed up over the holidays with another horse specialist who's located in Tribeca Canyon in Cota de Casa, which is in Orange County, California, and we're going to be doing a demonstration down there on February 4th. So if there's anybody interested that would like to join us for that demonstration, they're more than welcome to. Just go to my website, www.drmelodyfox.com. That's DrMelodyFoxx, as an x-ray.com. And you can get more information and get a hold of me through there, and that would be great.
All right. And if anybody out there, if you're driving and you couldn't write that down, you can always go and get Melody's information on the website at answers4thefamilyblog.com.
Yeah. So I've been really busy being a horsey person. And I love it.
Well, that's great. I think that's a great niche that you have. And I think I know a little bit about it. I've studied a little bit about it. And I think it's a great way to really get in touch with people. So I think you're doing great.
Well, thanks. It just gets to the heart of the matter so quickly and opens up so much insight and aha moments to take back into the therapy office to continue working on. And I just love it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. Just like here. I love here. It's so good to see you, Alan.
It's good to see you.
It's been a long time. We've been different schedules this holiday season.
All right. Well, this year we're going to continue to bring you, the listeners, many guests that can inspire and educate as well as entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
Well, we will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, spiritually sound. With each of us having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, you know, we've both been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields. We're all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will continue to bring some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now today we're going to be discussing America, and we want to talk about what made it the most prosperous and generous nation in the world and what may have caused its decline. We will examine our nation's founding values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the leadership principles that brought those values to life in America. And finally, we will explore the role that young people will play in restoring America to her former greatness and what parents must do to encourage and empower their children to play that role.
Now, our guest today is Chris Salamon, and he is a successful entrepreneur, attorney, and one of the nation's foremost experts on the next generation leadership. Now, Chris has dedicated over the last 20 years of his professional life to teaching and creating leadership and educational development programs specifically for teenagers and young adults, which have impacted the lives of hundreds of thousands of students from across America and over 50 countries from around the world. Now, he is the founder and former CEO of Lead America and the National Student Leadership Conferences. He has also served on the board of directors of the Florence Fuller Child Development Centers and is acting CEO of Chasen Music Group and is co-founder and chairman of the board of the Spartan Capital Investors.
And Mr. Salamon is the author of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling book, Rescue America, which is what we will be talking about today. Mm-hmm. Now, the subcategory is Our Best America is Only One Generation Away, in which he makes the irrefutable connection between our nation's decline and departure from our founding values. He asserts that what is necessary to return America to its greatness is a fundamental shift toward a national embodiment of the three driving principles that made America the most prosperous and most generous nation in the history of the world: the principles of gratitude, personal responsibility, and sacrifice. Chris, I got to let you know, I'm reading the book right now, and I love the fact, you know, that you're willing to provide answers to tough questions, and I love the fact that you not only outline what the problem is, but you have a solution. So, Chris, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, Alan, thank you so much, and great to be with you, Dr. Fox. Wonderful to be with you as well. And I couldn't help but hear your introduction regarding the horses. And so, being from the Northeast, I'm a little bit more like the Billy Crystal in City Slickers is more how I felt when you were describing that. So, if you can visualize that first scene with them on the horses, that would be me.
You know what? Those are my favorite people to work with. They haven't come out, but they've never been around a horse, and it's fun to watch them put the bridle on upside down, this way, that way, and it's a wonderful experience. And I know people that are terrified of horses that come out, and they just fall in love, and they leave with a new appreciation for themselves and the horses.
Well, next time I'm out there, I'm going to be a good case study for you.
Oh, I'd love for you to come out and join us. That'd be great.
Yeah, I would love it.
Yeah, we will hold you to that.
That's great, but you're right. The book I think was very timely in its presentation. And you know, really, there's two major premises. And if I may begin with sort of the first premise, which you sort of alluded to in the introduction, and that is the book makes the irrefutable connection. And I'll say it the opposite way that it was mentioned in the introduction. I believe the book makes an irrefutable connection between a very specific set of values, those being life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and a very specific set of driving principles, which we'll discuss hopefully today, and the unparalleled prosperity that America has experienced over the last 235 years, and equally importantly, the most unparalleled generosity in the history of the world. So that first premise is really, I think, very important, that, and that's where the book begins, is sort of what made America great, right? Because if we're going to talk about why isn't America decline, I think the first thing you have to look at is, you know, where did we come from? How did we get where we are? What made America irrefutably, I believe, certainly the most prosperous nation in the world? And it is a very, very specific set of values. Mm-hmm. And what I find incredible is, I look at and we studied the founders and the founding fathers. You know, they truly were geniuses when you think about it, because they took seven simple words and three principles. Right, the seven words being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those three principles, seven words, and yet it changed the course of history. That's truly genius, to boil something down to its very essence and yet have such a profound effect on the history of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can jump in wherever you think it's relevant to with regard to your audience, but that's the first main premise of the book. The second main premise of the book is that the common discourse, the dialogue that people are having today and the debate they're having today, both politically and probably in every sandwich shop and coffee shop in America, is, why is America in decline? And I think what's happening is we're confusing in that discourse effects of the decline with the cause of the decline. And again, I think that's another sort of large area for us to talk about. But basically, the premise being that the cause of decline is not, we have the wrong president, or it was the prior president who made the mistakes, or it was this policy, or it was that policy. Those are all, and they all may be true to some degree or another, as effects, but those are effects of our decline. The true cause of our decline, as the second premise, is that we have, for the better part of 60 to 70 years, failed to have a generational transfer from one generation to the next of these very, very essential values and principles that made America this great nation that it is. And I think that's the relevance really to your audience, right, is this generational transfer idea.
Yeah, and Chris, you talk with so much passion about this, and I was just really curious, what initially motivated you to write Rescue America?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. It was, I had I was taking a little bit of decided to take a little bit of a sabbatical, and I decided to write a book. And my goal was to write a book on leadership. I had been teaching leadership for the better part of 20 years, running one of the largest organizations in the country that taught leadership to children, having over 100,000 young people having gone through these various leadership programs. And as I did that, it was late 2009, early 2010, and as I looked around, sort of the world, the country and the world was falling apart around us. And you know, I went online, I Googled leadership books, and I said, okay, how can I have a different take on leadership? When I Googled it, there was like 62,000 responses, right? There's some over 60,000 leadership books out there on different ways to talk to people about how to lead. And so, you know, as King Solomon said 4,000 years ago, there's nothing new under the sun, right? So I thought, you know, that might be a little, right now, might be a little mundane. It might be, you know, not so impactful to write a book that 62,000 other people have decided to write on a similar sort of topic. So I was sitting with a colleague of mine who ended up being a co-author with me on the book, Professor Gilbert Morris. And as we were talking about how we've been teaching children for the last 20 years, and what we realized was that America was the single greatest case study in leadership in the history of mankind. And so as we took a closer look at it, we realized that the very principles, when you boil them down to three, the three pillars, when you boil down the main core leadership principles that we've been teaching for 20 years to children, they are the same principles that I call the driving mechanisms or driving principles that brought the values of America, values being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that brought those to life. Mm-hmm. And those three principles being the principle of gratitude, the principle of personal responsibility, and the principle of sacrifice, or as we call it, GPS, right, guiding principles.
Well, that's something easy to remember when you're driving around town.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In your car, it's a good way to think about it. Exactly. Exactly. So that's how the book came about. And so we set about in doing the research and spending a significant amount of time really making the book, I think, very rich in historical and philosophical references. Who were the philosophers? What were the theories that the founders used in order to come up with this very simple yet very profound set of values? And then how did those three principles of gratitude, personal responsibility, and sacrifice, how did those really get ingrained into the American culture through the founders and then through the early immigrants in particular and then through the World War II generation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Chris, one of the things that you said just a few minutes ago that I really like was the fact you talked about that, you know, people are sitting around the coffee shop and essentially they're blaming. You know, they're saying, well, you know, it's because of this president or it's because of the last president or it's because of whatever. And I think that, you know, from the standpoint of not really taking personal responsibility, you know, they're being taught that. I mean, you're literally being taught, you know, one party is saying, okay, you know, don't, you know, we're not going to take responsibility, blame the other one. And then the other party says, well, we're not going to take responsibility, we're going to blame the other one. And I think it's gotten so focused on the fact of you know, trying to get elected, trying to present their own agenda, that neither side is really taking personal responsibility for where we're at now or really offered any form of sacrifice as to how we're going to get to the next level, mm-hmm. and that being a positive level.
Right.
There's absolutely no question about that, and you know, it might, you know, maybe it's a good place to jump in, and I can, you know, we can go back to gratitude. But you mentioned this idea of personal responsibility. So, you know, if it's okay, maybe we can discuss that.
Sure.
For a moment. You know, you're exactly right. The minute, you know, again, you only have to turn on any news channel or turn on your radio, any channel except yours probably, and you're going to hear someone blaming someone else for the lot in life that either they have or someone else has or that the nation now has. Mm-hmm. And it's become an epidemic. And I call it in the book, I have this, I have a little phrase, and it's sort of a subsection of this idea of personal responsibility, but I call it an adversity to adversity. Right? We've gotten mm-hmm. to a point where anything that goes wrong, we immediately feel this need to find out whose fault it is, who's to blame, point the finger at someone else, or in the case of our kids, for the most part, what I found with parents over the last 20 years, more and more and more and more, is that we try to take away the pains of our children, and we don't want them to have to have. And so it's with the best of intentions. So when I talk about things here today that, you know, may sound a little bit tough, or may sound, you know, like we're trying to find what are the cause of certain things, it's by no means to question intention. It's really more about here's the optics that I see and how it's playing out in America. Mm-hmm. And so this adversity to adversity, and you see parents every day that go into school, a child does something. I tell the story about my niece who got in trouble one day on the school bus, and the bus driver said, you know, I'm going to report you at the school and you're going to have detention. And my niece turned and said to the bus driver, you know, my uncle's a lawyer and he'll sue you. So there's this immediate reaction to say, I'm going to get somebody else to fix this, this adversity for me.
Right.
And adversities, as I have found, are the, you know, they're the toolbox for greatness. They're the toolbox for extraordinary. They're the toolbox for learning. Adversities can also be called failures. They can be called setbacks. They can be called all these things. But without them, how do we ever get to where we want to go? We watch every movie we watch that inspires us. Every movie we want to go see and are willing to pay $10 or $12 now at the movie theater to see, all have the same sort of theme, right? They have somebody who has had some great adversity. Mm-hmm. They've struggled. They've fallen down. It seems hopeless, but yet they've found a way to nonetheless get back up and keep going. And that's the idea of you know, personal responsibility. So I think we've come to a point in our country where we've really taken on this idea of fault as opposed to responsibility, right? It can be someone's responsibility and not be their fault. So I read a Wall Street Journal article several months back, and it was right after the stock market had sort of crashed, and the S&P, the Standard & Poor's, had downgraded America's credit rating. And in this case, and again, you could pick the administration, right? Because the book, in fact, never mentions the word Republican or Democrat in it. It's meant to be a book that's factually based upon how we got to where we are, what made us great, and what we need to do about it. So it's not a partisan thing that I'm saying. But I listened to a press conference at the White House, and they said, "What do you think caused this downgrade?" And here's what the article said. First, the government blamed the economy and the downgrade on the tsunami in Japan. Mm-hmm. They went on to blame it on the Mideast uprising. And then they actually blamed the downgrade on the downgrade. and I read this article and I thought, now, if that is not how can you ever get to a solution when there's a complete inability to take any responsibility or even to acknowledge that, you know, there has to be some responsibility on the part of government, right? We blame banks, we blame this group, we blame, you know, whatever the flavor of the month is that we want to blame, as opposed to really looking where the causes are. Mm-hmm. I tell the story when we talk about this adversity to adversity, if I may just take another moment, imagine a young person has a football team at their school, and you go, And their football team, if you go watch them practice during the summertime, what you see is a unique thing. While they're practicing, they're learning something very important. They're learning how to block. They're learning how to tackle. But more importantly, they're learning how to hit, get hit, fall down, get back up, and keep going.
Right.
And so you watch them, and they do these exercises where, you know, they run into these things called sleds. You have the coaches standing on them, and they run into these sleds, and they push it. You know, it's a big, heavy chunk of steel with a big, heavy coach standing on it, and they run into it. And after they hit it, then they drop on the ground, and they roll over, and they go up to the next pad, and they hit that and push it forward. They're constantly practicing this idea of getting knocked down, getting back up. Now, imagine if you had a football team, and it's a silly example, but I think it makes the point. Imagine you had a football team who had practiced every play. They've studied every play. They knew every play the opponent was going to do. They knew exactly where they're supposed to run. They knew exactly what position to be in, how to hold their hands, where their feet should be. They'd studied it perfectly. They knew all the X's and O's of the game of football. The only problem is, never once in their life had they ever practiced getting hit or getting knocked down. And so they go to their first game, and they know more than the other team. They know every play. The kickoff comes. The player gets the ball, and for the first time in his life, he gets hit, and he gets knocked down onto the field. And he screeches out. He's got a little bruise on his hip. He's not really hurt, but he just lays there. And then he reaches into his pocket, pulls out a cell phone, and he dials speed dial 1. And he says, "Mom, it's me. I got knocked down in the game. Can you come pick me up?" Now, it's a ridiculous example, but what it tells us is, you know, why do football players practice getting knocked down and getting back up? They practice because that's the game of football. And in life, we get knocked down metaphorically over and over and over again. And those are the times that we learn. That is how, you know, we get a thicker skin. It's how we become able to handle the future adversities, right? It's a building process, as you know, Dr. Fox, it's a building process. Everything we learn builds on the next so that eventually when we become adults and we're faced with the real challenges of life, we're much better equipped to handle them.
Exactly. And, you know, it kind of goes into what you speak about in your book about culture and attitude of entitlement and complaint. It's like this entitlement that we're going to get rescued and we don't have to take personal responsibility and we could just, you know, expect things to happen, other people to rescue us, and then we could sit around and complain about it. Can you expand on that? Because I'm just seeing that it seems to be slowly infesting American society. And you speak about how it is, particularly in the younger generations of Americans who have come to believe that they are simply entitled to many of the things that earlier generations understood had to be worked out for and earned for, like learn the plays of the football game. You know, how did this generation adapt to this mentality? And is it a product of the media or Hollywood, pop culture, or something that parents are doing that need to change?
Yeah, and let me again begin by making the point to say my comments are not a comment about intention, because I believe people do have the best of intentions, right? They don't intend to destroy. People think we're doing what's right. They think they're doing what's advancing. They think they're doing what's making things better. And then just as a preliminary to that, the other point before I directly answer the question, I just want you to imagine a nation, the difference between two nations. And you can just in your mind's eye, and your listeners can in their own mind's eye, imagine a nation where its core philosophy, its culture, is a culture of gratitude, a culture of personal responsibility, and a culture of sacrifice. And then imagine a nation where its culture, ingrained into its citizenry, is a culture of entitlement and complaint. You can just see in your mind's eye two completely different nations. And that's the part that has me so concerned, is that we are really at that point in time, we're at that tipping point where it's become, I believe, a cultural problem. It's no longer just, well, we have some people that think a certain way. It's become ingrained in our culture. And I think what's happened is this, you know, when and how did it happen? Here's what our research has shown. Basically, around the World War II generation, again, it's not to blame that generation, right, because they were phenomenal. They were, Tom Brokaw called them the greatest generation, and they truly were. However, what happened is that generation and their parents, you know, my great-grandparents came from Palermo, Sicily in 1903, and they landed with two bags in their hand, five people, two bags, $20 in their pocket. No job, no promise of anything. All they had was the hope of something great, and they had a set of values that they could rely upon, that they knew in this nation what they worked for, they got to keep. And if they fell down, they had the opportunity to get back up, and there was no ceiling on what they could accomplish. They could become their best selves, whatever best that was for them. And so what I think happened is this World War II generation, they saw the generation before them. They saw their parents and their grandparents, and they saw how they struggled, and then how they themselves struggled, right, with you know, the Depression and World War II. And they decided, and suddenly they came out of it the other side so strong. And suddenly, America was on this unbelievable incline, this unbelievable progress that we were having, and prosperity. And they said, you know, we can pass a better life on to our children. We don't want our kids to have to struggle the way we did. And that's a very noble thought, right? So I said, it's not about intention. Who doesn't want their children to have a better life than they did? But in that process, what happened is we began to fix all of the problems, to fix all of the adversities. We began to give them things that they hadn't earned, and without instilling in them an understanding that these things aren't something they're just entitled to, but rather, you know, these are gifts, and these are things that they then have to be grateful for if they're not going to work for them. So that's really how it happened. And I think all of the things that you mentioned, from Hollywood, pop culture, music, and government itself, right, has created this great problem. John Stuart Mill, a 19th century philosopher, a British philosopher, he called it the tyranny of the majority, right? And what he feared most is that you eventually get a majority that imposes its will on the individual. And that's really the opposite of what America was founded for and what he feared even more. And we can talk about this, and I'm sure you're very familiar, you know, with all these statistics on education. But the more uneducated of a population we have, the more dangerous it becomes. Because John Stuart Mill's thought, he said eventually his fear was the majority emerges over time from an uneducated mass. And eventually those people become the majority and soon demand all of the, as he called it, the spoils of society without regard for, as he said, the toil that's regarded, that's needed, or the labor that's needed to cultivate that those spoils.
Well, Chris, so, I got to tell you, I just saw a YouTube video of an interview, a news interview of a college professor that was driving home exactly what it is you're talking about. And what he was talking about was he said he did a survey of his class and he had them all write what is it that they expect to get out of government. And then he read what some of the things were, and what he was saying was they said, we expect to be given money for a home. We expect to be given a free education. We expect to be given a job when we get out of school, and that was not contingent on if I can do the job well. It was this became a right, not a privilege. And he went on and talked about that, and because I was doing a little bit of a research in regards to your book, and as I was typing in different things, that was one of the things that came up. But he drives exactly what you're talking about. He drives that message home, and I want to continue to talk about it. We're going to take a quick break. So for everybody, we will be right back. We are talking about Rescue America. The author is Chris Salamone, and we will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. We're back, and we're talking about Rescue America. We are talking with Chris Salamone, and what his book is really, what he believes is, our best America is only one generation away. Mm-hmm. Melanie, while we were off the air, we were talking a little bit about, you know, how personal responsibility goes into sacrifice.
Well, yeah, right before you were discussing about how, and Chris, please jump in any time, but the sacrifice, because
sure.
I'd like for you to expand about that, but my idea when you guys were talking about this was that sacrifice, students have this sense of entitlement when they just come out of school, but they're not willing to sacrifice learning the craft, maybe taking a lower pay or do something for free to learn what they're doing. They're expecting to go in at top level jobs with top pay, and they have that expectation going in. I have working with interns and all that, they don't like the idea they have to be interns. They don't understand why can't they get a big job paying good money right out of college. It just amazes me, the sense of entitlement.
It really is, and I'll tell you, I have not seen that YouTube. I'm gonna seek that out and look at that, because that is and I would say it's troubling, but it's troubling in the sense that I've seen it in other forms, right? Many, many other forms. And so, as I said earlier, when you look at a nation and you just, in your mind's eye, picture a nation that has as its core culture an attitude, a belief, a culture of entitlement. And when we don't get what we want or what we believe we're entitled to, see, when we think we're entitled to something, that's when we complain. Because we don't believe it's something that we have to work for. We don't believe that it's something that's a privilege. We don't believe that it's something that, hey, you win some, you lose some. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail. You get back up, you keep going. It's all part of a process. when you just believe you're entitled to it, when you don't get it, your immediate reaction, the natural reaction, is to complain about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a nation that once we believe this as our and becomes ingrained as a culture, all we have is people who don't get what they want, and then we complain, and we then vote in people who will give us what we want. And then we feel satisfied for a short time, only till we don't get what we want. And then we complain some more, vote in more people, give us what we want. And we then eventually have this tyranny of the majority.
So where does the sacrifice
come in? It's a vicious cycle.
I'm just curious, where does the sacrifice come in your opinion?
Well, the sacrifice is this. When you look at the three principles, right? Personal responsibility is the glue that holds together gratitude and sacrifice. And I'm glad we'll hold gratitude to last, because I really it's the starting point, but I also believe it's circular, and it's mm-hmm. also the most important, or one of the most important.
Yep.
This idea of sacrifice is this. What I see is that we're missing right now in our society is we're missing this line of connection. I have a tremendous amount of respect for our military people, and right now we have folks, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in theaters all over the world. And whether you agree with them, and there are things that I definitely do not agree with, that we are doing militarily, and that's fine. So whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it has no relevance whatsoever. But what we're lacking right now is this line of connection, a line of connection between the few who sacrifice so much to protect the freedoms and the values that are what America stands for, and the many who get to enjoy the benefits of those sacrifices. Right? When you have a people who want the benefits of American exceptionalism without the obligations or responsibilities, you soon have a nation that's not going to exist at the level that it existed for a very long time. And so how do you restore this line of connection between those who sacrifice every day and those who don't? You know, I use this just as an example, and I don't mean it in any disparaging way whatsoever, because as an American, she has a right to do what she wants to do. And I feel bad for her many times, because she's a young girl. I watch the news and I see Lindsay Lohan, and I see the things that go on with her and the things that have happened to her. And in my mind, I say to myself, you know, it's amazing that in the same society we have Lindsay Lohan and we have Pat Tillman. And for your listeners who don't know, Pat Tillman was a NFL football star making millions of dollars, had the American dream, everything that, you know, most people could say they would want in their life. He was living his boyhood dream of being a professional football player, married to the girl of his dreams. And when, after 9/11, he just decided, because he felt such an obligation to his country for all the wonderful gifts and privileges that he's been given, he left the NFL, joined the Airborne Rangers, wouldn't even do interviews about why he did this. And so it was killed in action subsequently. Now, again, you don't have to agree. People would say, well, that was stupid. Why would he go do that? It doesn't matter whether you agree with his belief system or not. But the point is, you know, how in the same society we can have a Pat Tillman and a Lindsay Lohan? There has to be a line of connection where, and I just use her again as an example, not in any disparaging way, where you have this connection that says, you know what, I understand that in some countries, if I steal that necklace, you know, if I did that in Iran, they'd actually chop my hand off. If I acted the way I acted in some nations, you know, I might be stoned or put to death. Only because I'm in America do I have the privilege and the right to be the person that I want to be. Whether that's great, not great, people agree with it, don't agree with it, we get to be that. But at some level, I believe there needs to be this line of connection between those who sacrifice so much. You know, I'm reminded of I tell the story in the book of the movie from Freedom Writers. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie or not, but true story about a school out there in California, and a teacher takes over the worst of the worst class, and eventually over time she gets the class sort of turned around, and they begin reading the Diary of Anne Frank. And in reading that, they find that this woman, May Gies, who had harbored Anne Frank and a group of other Jews during the Holocaust and didn't save them, but had harbored them and tried to save their lives, was still alive and living in Austria. They do a fundraiser. They fly her to L.A. They bring her into the class. The woman walks into the class. She sits down, and this young boy, who was the worst of the worst of these kids, when I say worst, meaning he had grown up in a very tough environment, was, you know, into gang violence and all these things, and he got up and he said, looked at her with tears in his eyes, and he said, you know, I've never had I've never had an idol in life, but I want you to know that you're my idol. Oh, wow. And she looked at him and she said, he said, you're my hero. And she looked at him and she said, I'm no hero. I just did what was right. Mm-hmm. And then she said something that was, to me, is this point about sacrifice, right? This idea, she said something more profound. She said, even an ordinary person like me can turn on a small light in a dark room. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's this idea. Sacrifice doesn't mean we all have to leave what we're doing, go join the Airborne Rangers and, you know, be in the military. That's not what I'm saying. This idea of sacrifice is that for us to have the future that we want to have, it takes vigilance. It doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen because we wish for it. Believe it or not, it's a great campaign slogan. And again, I'm not trying to disparage any one person or party. Right? Hope is not a method. We didn't become the greatest nation on earth as a result of hope. We became the greatest nation on earth as a result of self-reliance and a result of vigilance and a result of standing for something and every day recognizing that as easy as it has come, it can be taken away if we don't understand it. You know, I mentioned it before, but I watched with great awe the reaction of the Japanese people to the tsunami. And I watch people stand after having been devastated, lost everything. They're starving. They're malnourished. They're dehydrated. Standing in line, quietly, respectfully, mm-hmm. not pushing, not fighting, not the strongest survive, and we're going to beat up people who are in front of us to get the water that we need. That's a cultural reaction to that problem, to that crisis. That was ingrained. That didn't happen by accident. That didn't happen because they woke up one day and said, oh, we have a crisis. Today we're going to act in a certain way. They did that because from generation to generation to generation, that had been passed down. And again, the difficulty I think we're facing today is, again, not intentionally, but because we're so busy, because we've advanced so much, right, two parents working, all of these things, we have not passed along that same with a vigilance and a determination, that same set of values and those three principles to our children, our children's children, and children's children's children.
Exactly. Well,
yeah, and Chris, and I've got two thoughts to that. One is that when you brought up the situation about the Japanese tsunami, there was also a video that was put together in Japan that was sent over to throughout the world, and it was a thank you. Because they were acknowledging, which goes right into gratitude, but they were acknowledging all of the different countries, and they talk about the fact that, you know, that these Americans came over, and these Israelis came over, and these people from New Zealand came over, and all of the different countries that sent help, that sent, you know, ships, everything they could possibly send. But it goes right into what you're saying. They were showing gratitude because it was in their culture to show gratitude. Now, when you brought up about in regards to Tillman and in regards to Lohan, I think that we've always had people like that. I mean, there's always been some Lohans and there's always been some Tillmans. What seems to have happened is we've had a shift to where percentage-wise, I think we've got too many going in the direction of entitlement. And how do we get that shift to now move back the other way? There's always going to be some. We can't right. stop it. But how do we shift it back to where it becomes the cool thing, it's the right thing, and it's the thing that everybody's proud of and that you want to share with people that we're going to take some responsibility and we're going to show some gratitude?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, this whole idea that you mentioned of, you know, the Japanese sending this video, again, something I'd love to see. This idea of gratitude, I think, is a principle that is a, I call it, you know, it's a paradigm shifter. It changes the whole paradigm. When you begin from a place and come from a place of gratitude as your first instinct, as your first core value, when that's your first instinct, it changes everything. It changes the way you look at the world. It changes the way you see things, as opposed to coming at the world from a place of entitlement. You know, I believe this. I believe that we're born in arrears, meaning that we're born with an inheritance that we did not and we could not have earned. Right? As Americans, we have not earned the 230 years of sacrifice that has been made for us in order to have the rights and the privileges that we have as Americans. We could not have earned that. at the time we're born. And so we're already born in arrears, which means our first instinct in life has to be gratitude. And then our parents care for us and raise us has to be gratitude. But it can only be gratitude if that's, you know, if that's taught, right? And so, you know, Martin Luther King wrote about this, or I should say spoke about this, and he said, you know, to this idea that we've been given much, he said, when the architects of a republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. Right? Now, that's saying we were given something. So when we're given something, you know, we're handed something, what is the reaction, right? We say thank you. You know, thank you isn't just a word. Thank you is meant to say we're grateful for the fact that we've been given something. Now, I know it's an intangible when you talk about these values, right? But it's not an intangible to people who come to this country from other countries. And so I watched with great interest this documentary on a woman traveled around the country, and she went to every state to see the swearing-in of new immigrants being sworn in to be American citizens. And I have to tell you, probably one of the most inspiring documentaries I've ever seen. To see these people at all of all ages, their first instinct, they were literally, some literally down on their knees, like my great-grandfather was, I'm told, when they came to Ellis Island, down on their knees kissing the ground at Ellis Island because his first instinct was gratitude. But these people all said basically the same thing. They said, we cannot believe how happy we are and how privileged we feel to be in America, and we are committed to make something of ourselves because we have been given this privilege to be here. I mean, think about that, just the privilege to be here. And so sometimes when we're born into something, you know, we take it for granted, and that's understandable, right? It's the paradox of prosperity. I write about that in the beginning of the book. It happens to companies. It happens to individuals. The more successful you become, the more prosperous you become, the better you become, the more you forget about the things that actually made you prosperous in the first place. And so when we're born into it, it's just sort of, for us, it's the way it is. And we don't see how it is in other parts of the world. But these people who come from these other places, mm-hmm. they come here, and it is such a dramatic difference. Even places that you know, you would say, well, they're a free society now. Well, they may be free, but imagine even in England, they still have people they call commoners. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was appalled when I watched the wedding there, and they said, can you imagine the first time a commoner has ever married into royalty? And I thought, could you imagine in America if they ever tried to just call someone a commoner? You know, it would not be, wouldn't go over very well.
No,
So you know, this idea is we're born into arrears, and I just think if you have this idea of gratitude, it creates a different citizen, a different employee, a different politician. And you know, my own personal anecdote on sort of this lack of gratitude that I see is, on Memorial Day 2 years ago, one of my dearest friends is a Marine. That I guess there's no such thing as a former Marine, so he's a Marine who's no longer active in the Marine Corps. And he spent 8 years of his life going around the world defending our country. And on Memorial Day, he asked everyone, there's about 100 people, combination of parents and kids, he asked everyone if we could just have 5 minutes of silence. And during that 5 minutes, he played the Gettysburg Address. And as the Gettysburg Address was playing, I looked at my watch. It was about a minute into it. Everybody first stopped, and they all, you know, paid attention. After about 1 minute, he asked for 5 minutes. All he asked was for 5 minutes. The Gettysburg Address was four. He asked for five. And I saw people start to go back to scooping baked beans out of the baked bean pot. And I saw people going over to the bar and getting another drink. And I saw, you know, kids laughing about however the words were in the Gettysburg Address. I thought to myself, you know, my goodness, if we can't even take 5 minutes mm-hmm. to show gratitude for our nation on Memorial Day,
right.
what hope do we have?
And talking about hope, you're talking about the generations in the book and helping that. What is the role? And we only have a few minutes left, but I want to know quickly in your thought, what is the role of the parent in getting America back on track?
Absolutely. You know what? And I want to make this point that I am, you know, the book is a hopeful book, by the way. The book is a positive book.
Very.
I believe that we can, and I know it sounds we're talking a lot about the things that are wrong, but to get to what's right, to straighten things out, we have to understand where we're going wrong. So that's why we're talking about this. This idea of parents, Look, the interesting thing, there's some very interesting statistics, and I'm sure Dr. Fox, you're aware of these. Right now, the average parent spends 38 and a half minutes per week of meaningful conversation with their children, according to an AC Nielsen study. 38 and a half minutes a week. That same child spends about 1,600 minutes a week watching television. So the first thing, we have to talk to our kids. We have to spend more time. Secondly, coming from an Italian family, I believe the dinner table is the place where that happens. And I know it's hard because, you know, we have soccer practice, basketball practice, violin, all these things are going on, and we're running from here to there. But again, a study was done at Harvard University that found that family dinners are more important than play, story time, other family events in the development of vocabulary, that frequent family meals are associated with a lower risk for children, lower risk of smoking, lower risk of drinking, lower risk of using drugs, a lower incidences of depression and symptoms of suicidal thoughts, and the students get better grades.
Absolutely.
Adolescent girls, frequent family meals create a positive atmosphere where they're less likely to have eating disorders, and kids who eat with their parents are 40% more likely to report A's and B's than kids who have fewer two or less dinners a week. Can you imagine something as simple as having dinner with your parents? So that's the first part. The second part is this idea of teaching gratitude, and gratitude can be taught. Mm-hmm. There was an article, and again, there's studies that back this up as well. But a woman did an article, I think it was for the Washington Post, and she was a professor of psychology, and she found that grateful children are happier children, and so are their parents. Mm-hmm. They found that they have better relationships with their family, better relationships with friends, again, higher GPAs, less materialism, less envy, less depression. So there's all kinds of psychological, social, and physical benefits, including lower blood pressure, according to the report. So this idea, if we can begin to instill in our teens, begin having them say thank you. You know, repetition is the mother of skill, learning, and understanding. Mm-hmm. We have to, insist that our children, it's not just, hey, it's how you want it when you want it. It's you have to understand every day. My colleague who wrote the book with me, Dr. Morris, he sits his two boys, they're young boys, and so he sits them on both sides of the sink when he shaves in the morning. And he says, do you know why Daddy's shaving this morning? And now, of course, they can answer him. He says, Daddy's shaving because Daddy has to go to work, and Daddy has to earn money so that we can have food on the table so that you can eat tonight, and that you can have something to eat, and that you can have clothes that you wear. So they're teaching them that these things, they don't just come to them. Right. They're worked for, and that there are sacrifices being made every day in order to have the things that they're given.
And they wouldn't know it if it wasn't discussed and talked about and emulated for them. And
That's part of teaching and being
a parent. And you know what, Chris? We are so short on time right now.
I'm sorry.
No. This is great. But the one thing we want to make sure that we get in there is that for anybody, I mean, we've touched on a lot of it. As I said, I'm reading the book right now. If anybody wants to get the book and check it out yourself, you can go to www.rescueamericabook.com.
The easiest place is actually Amazon. Of course, it's carried in every bookstore in America right now, or you can go to Amazon.com and get it as well. And all the proceeds of the book are being given to the Wounded Warrior Project, so we do encourage people to pick up a copy, give a copy to a friend. The proceeds are going to a great cause, and I'm very thankful to have been a part of your show today.
Well, we're so thankful for you and grateful that you came on board, and I know we could go on for hours on this discussion and topics and a lot of side topics that came up along the way, but thank you so much for joining us on Answers for the Family. We really appreciate
it. Dr. Fox, thank you. Alan, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. We hope to have you on again. Thanks. Bye now.
I would like it. Thank you.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.